Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
I need to lose weight. Diet. Deprivation. Misery. Ugh.
What if you could lose weight without feeling awful? R3 Weight Loss by Susan Torberg is the real food plan you've been dreaming about. No calorie counting or journaling. A doable plan for real life. With R3 Weight Loss, you'll break those sugar and carb cravings but still be able to eat things you love, teaching you discipline and managing your weight for life. Visit r3weightlossplan.com. $39 will change your life.
Happy New Year, and welcome. It's Kathy Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and this is our first live broadcast of 2020, hoping that it will be an excellent one and the first of many excellent ones. And one of the ways we assure that is we have Jimmy Akin come in. Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, is our guest this hour for an open forum. You can call with any question you like about the Catholic faith, Catholic people, Catholic belief, or anything else on earth. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. Happy New Year, Jimmy.
Happy New Year, Cy. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. So far, I've reached all my goals for 2020, which my primary goal was to set no goals for 2020. So thus far, I'm doing really good on that.
It's a little bit of a paradox, isn't it?
It's like one of those time
Your
ones.
Goal is to go set back no in time. Goals. I mean, it's sort of self-refuting.
It is. You're right. But I guess maybe it's so no goals beyond this one.
You started the year with failure.
Or with astonishing success, Jimmy, depending on how you feel about paradoxi or paradoxes.
There's a great early episode of Star Trek Next Generation where Data says, "May I ask a question?" And someone says, "You just did. Then may I ask another one after this one?"
Which he is currently doing, and that could go on forever.
But he's asked another one after this one.
Oh! I see. After this one, that I'm
same
asking
as
now.
Your goal, not to set any goals after this one.
Yeah. Well, how about you? How's your New Year going?
It's going happy well. New Year? Yeah. Got a bunch of stuff done. It's Friday, so that's nice.
Yep. I'm going to guess have not ridden a horse yet in the year 2020.
I have in the past, but
I don't even know if I rode a horse in the year 2019. I might have gone the whole year without riding a horse.
Do you ride horses often?
No, less than once a year now, apparently.
Okay.
But when you think about it, though.
Don't set it as a goal.
It's not a goal. Yeah. No. I like horses. They really have no respect for me, though. I mean,
really?
I think you're supposed to have some... force of personality.
You have to show the horse who's boss.
I do show the horse who's boss. The horse knows right away who's boss, and it's not me.
Yeah.
That's my problem.
I was once taking a class in horsemanship, and in the textbook, towards the front, it was talking about horses, and it said, of course, it talked about horses through the whole textbook.
Really?
Towards the beginning, it was saying, you know, horses are intelligent but skittish animals. And I mentally added, based on a few experiences I'd had in class, that they are also lazy and deceptive.
Oh.
Because if the, like one of
they're
the
like
horses.
They're like the video department.
Oh, sorry.
Just kidding
careful.
There, Zach. It was a joke, Zach.
Careful. Video department can make you look bad.
I know.
But like one of the horses I had been riding, the assignment was I'm in an arena and I'm supposed to ride the horse around the circumference of the arena. And you use your, at least at this stage of it, you're assigned to use your legs to control the horse and tell the horse where to move.
Oh, yeah.
And so I would keep having to nudge the horse with my knees towards the edge of the arena, because what the horse was trying to do was simply walk directly from one end of the arena to the other.
Because he's not a dumb horse.
He wouldn't be making a big loop. He'd be just walking in a straight line, which would be shorter.
Right.
So the horse showed some geometrical awareness, which is smart.
Yeah.
You know, but what the horse doesn't realize is I'm paying by the hour. You're not actually going to shorten your trip, even if I let you go in a straight line.
Yeah. Let's see. Open forum. A bunch of people on the line already. But we still got a few lines open. 888-318-7884 is the number. Jimmy Akin, if you're like, you're vow for 2020 was I'm going to start listening to Catholic Answers, and you've never listened before. Jimmy is the author of many books, including his latest book, which is called The Bible is a Catholic Book. And he's also the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
Yeah.
How's it going there?
It's going well. It's Friday, so we had a new episode drop today.
Mm-hmm. No, that's it? You're not going to tell me? Can I ask a question?
Yeah, you currently are.
What's today's episode about?
Today's episode is about Holy Blood, Holy Grail. This is a book that came out in 1982, and it hypothesized that there is a secret organization called the Priory of Zion that has existed since the time of the Crusades and is trying to install a theocratic monarchy all across Europe based on the descendants of Jesus, who were, and Jesus himself was never crucified, but instead was married to Mary Magdalene and had children.
Sounds very Dan Brown-y.
Yeah, that's guess who sued Dan Brown for plagiarism? Oh. It was the authors of Holy Blood, Holy Grail.
You stole our bad idea.
Yeah, exactly. So we had requests this month to do Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and
cool.
So we did. So if you want to find out, is there any truth to all that stuff?
Yes.
Take a listen. Just type in Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and listen to the latest episode.
All right. Another conspiracy. Yeah. Another one of those conspiracies.
Conspiracies are real. I mean, that's why we have laws against them.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Yeah. It's against the law to enter into a criminal conspiracy.
Yeah, yeah. A conspiracy is just an agreement by two or more people to commit a criminal act in the future.
Yeah. Right. So like organized crime.
That's a conspiracy.
That's a conspiracy. Yeah. And it's real.
Yep.
Maria in Florida is first up in the new year. We should have some kind of prize. Hey, let's send Maria a copy of Jimmy's book, The Bible is a
Catholic
Book.
A daily defense.
Oh, that's even better idea. Okay, let's send her both of those. All right. And let's take it out of your budget, Darren. Okay. Maria in Florida, listening on the Guadalupe Radio Network. You are first for the year. Your question for Jimmy. Hi, Maria.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, hello, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
And I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
And I had a question that kind of came to me as I was reading. I love reading the stories about the time of Christmas and the time of Christ's birth in the Gospel.
Uh-huh.
And in the Gospel of Matthew, and I don't have the verse in front of me, but it talks about Joseph and Mary and when she gave birth to the baby. But then it says that, referring to Joseph, that he knew her not until after she was delivered, you know, the baby.
Yes.
Wouldn't that imply that they did live together as husband and wife, or do you read that in another way?
Well, they did live together as husband and wife, but that doesn't mean they had marital intercourse. They lived as brother and sister, as one expression has it. This verse is, so it's Matthew 1:25. It comes up very commonly. People have been aware of this verse all the way down through church history. And it's been pointed out that in Greek, as in English, the word until does not necessarily imply a change of state. I mean, if I say I didn't eat until I got home, that you could take to imply that I did eat once I got home. But the word until doesn't automatically mean that. For example, if I say I never saw her again until the day I died, well, context tells you that means I never saw her ever. It doesn't mean I was a zombie after my death and saw her after my death. So you have to look at the context, what else we know about the situation, in order to decide whether or not the word until means that there's a change of a situation after the point being described. And among other things, we have good evidence from the Gospels and from the infancy narratives as well. That's the parts that tell about the birth and early childhood of Jesus. We have other evidence from the infancy narratives that indicate that Mary was not planning on having marital relations with Joseph. If you look in Luke's gospel, when the angel Gabriel appears to her at the end of Luke 1, Gabriel says, you know, behold, you're going to have a son, and he's going to be amazing in the following ways. And she says, how will this be, for I know not man? Well, think about the context. She's already legally married to Joseph. Mm-hmm. And so if she was planning on a normal marriage with normal marital relations between husband and wife, that would inform her response to what Gabriel says. And she would assume, oh, okay, well, I'm legally married to Joseph. I'm going to, you know, after the fetching of the bride ceremony, which was customary in Jewish culture, we're going to start living together. We're going to have marital relations, and I'm going to have a son as a result of those marital relations. And that's what the angel's telling me. So she would assume this is all going to happen in the near future through normal, through the normal course of affairs. But instead, she says, no, how is this going to be? She doesn't doubt that it's going to happen, but how is it going to happen? Because I don't know man, using the biblical sense of no, meaning I don't have marital relations with anybody. And the angel then explains the Holy Spirit is going to bring it about miraculously. Well, Mary obviously knows the facts of life, or she wouldn't ask the question. And the fact she asks the question when she's already married to somebody suggests she's not planning on a normal marriage with normal marital relations. We also have, now, I should mention, in the second century, there is a document that was written called the Proto-Evangelium of James. It's also sometimes called the Infancy Gospel of James, and it deals with the circumstances of Christ's birth. And according to it, Joseph was an elderly widower who already had a family and therefore was not looking to have new children. And that's why he was willing to become the husband of a consecrated virgin, so he could take care of her. Single women, you know, were in kind of a precarious position in the ancient world. And so since she was a consecrated virgin, he would be willing to become her husband, even though he did not plan to have her violate her vow of virginity. Now, that would imply Joseph is substantially older than Mary. If he's already an elderly widower, his passions have cooled, he's already got a family, so he's not looking to have a new family. Well, we find confirmatory evidence for that in the Gospels as well. If you look in the Gospel, all four of the Gospels, the last time we hear about Joseph, the last time we see him in the story is when Jesus is 12. But by the time Jesus starts his adult ministry, around age 30, according to Luke, Joseph is nowhere to be found. He never appears on camera again, so to speak. And if you look at the end of John's gospel, at the crucifixion, Mary is there, and Jesus tells Mary, woman, behold your son, referring to the beloved disciple. And he then tells the beloved disciple, behold your mother, referring to Mary. So he's establishing a relationship between Mary and the beloved disciple so that the beloved disciple will take care of Mary now that Jesus is going to be dead and then later going to go to heaven in the ascension. Well, that suggests that Joseph is not around, because otherwise Jesus would just say, after I'm dead, go home to Joseph. So Joseph probably was not alive at the time of the crucifixion, which could suggest he's significantly older than Mary. Also, if Mary had had other children, the natural thing to do would be to entrust her care to them. The fact that Jesus entrusts Mary's care to an outsider suggests that she didn't have any children of her own to care for her once Jesus was gone. And so we have a variety of lines of evidence, both within the New Testament and in the writings of the early church fathers, that indicate that Mary remained a virgin even after Jesus was born. And that provides the context for Matthew 1:25. Matthew is not saying Joseph did have marital relations with Mary after Jesus's birth. He's just making the point he didn't have any with her before Jesus's birth, so Joseph couldn't possibly be the father.
Maria, if you will hang on the line, our own Marie will get your address if it's amenable to you, and we'll send you those two books, The Bible is a Catholic Book and A Daily Defense. Thank you for being our first caller of the new year, 2020. We got to take a quick break. As we go to the break, just want to let you know that some of our friends that we met this year in Australia are struggling with those fires down there. And if you would offer a prayer for our friends and for everybody down in Australia facing those fires, I'm sure it will be much appreciated and do much good. We'll see you right back after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy Akin is coming right back.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Catholic Answers Live is proudly supported by CatholicChemistry.com, a new dating site for Catholics who want to do dating right and believe relationships start with Catholic chemistry. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicChemistry.com for their generous support. On the web at CatholicChemistry.com.
Check out EWTN's official YouTube channel.
Just follow the link on our homepage at EWTN.com or go to YouTube.com/EWTN.
Watch EWTN's live shows or today's homily from the Daily Mass.
Click the upload button to see our most recent clips.
You can also find all of EWTN YouTube content by clicking the playlist button.
It's all on the official EWTN YouTube channel at YouTube.com/EWTN.
Visit today.
Go forth and preach the good news. It's not just a suggestion. If you want to take more seriously the command of Jesus to share the gospel with those around you, consider joining St. Paul Street Evangelization. It's a grassroots organization that brings the Catholic faith to the streets in a non-confrontational way. Visit our website, www.streetevangelization.com, to learn more. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. It's time to do our part.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. It is an open forum this hour with Jimmy Akin. Next, kind of a bonus open forum, I guess. We don't usually do this on a Friday, but the time gets so confusing around the holidays for me.
Yeah.
I don't know how people had to keep reminding me that it's Friday.
You tend to become
today.
Unstuck in time, like Billy Pilgrim.
Yeah, but after this second hour today, Carlo will be here, and we're going to do the Bible Blueprint for Purgatory with Carlo Broussard after this hour. But tons and tons of folks on the line wanting to talk with Jimmy Akin. So we go to Ryan in New York, listening to EWTN. Channel 130 on Sirius XM satellite radio. Ryan, delighted to have you. Your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, hi. Can you guys hear me?
We can.
Hello?
Hello. Hey, what's your question, please. Ryan?
So, my question. Sorry, yeah, it's just, I'm in the car and it's a little.
That's okay.
Hard to hear you guys on the phone. But the question was I was raised Roman Catholic, made communion and confirmation. And I got married and married my wife, and she was Presbyterian. Mm-hmm. And so now we're married and have kids, and we're raising kids in the Presbyterian Church. And I was just kind of curious because there's some major differences, mostly in like the act of confession, where, you know, you don't confess to a priest, you kind of do a silent confession. And then, you know, as a Lutheran church, they ask for forgiveness. So, you know, obviously, we're all following the same book, but, you know, some of the comments are a little different, and I just was really kind of curious, you know, what the Catholic Church's view of that
Do you mean, if I may, Ryan, you mean that the Catholic Church's view of your situation, of now that you were married in the Presbyterian Church and you're practicing in the Presbyterian Church? Is that I just want to make sure I'm clear on, is that what you're asking, Jimmy? Okay. All right. We have a little delay. So go ahead, Jimmy.
Well, I could use a little additional. I mean, ideally, I would like a little additional clarity about exactly what Ryan is asking. Merely marrying someone who is a Presbyterian is not itself a problem. I mean, it's not a mortal sin. It's not the ideal. Mm-hmm. If you're a Catholic, it's not the ideal. The ideal is to be married to another Catholic and, you know, be united in the faith and provide a united witness as parents to your children as you raise them. Presbyterians are fellow Christians. And if you are a Catholic and you get permission from your bishop, to marry a Presbyterian, then you can do that and it's totally fine. If you don't, now there are some additional things that you need to do if in the process of getting that permission. You need to, you know, promise that you're going to adhere to, you know, you're going to maintain your Catholic faith and practice, and and you need to do what you can to see that your children are raised Catholic. And the Presbyterian partner would need to be informed of those commitments on your part. But that being done, if you're still willing to marry each other, the bishop can give permission and you can get married, and it's totally valid in the eyes of the church. If you don't do that, then there can be problems because it's not going to be recognized as a valid marriage, which is problem number one. Also, if you don't maintain your Catholic faith, then that's a problem as well. One of the things Ryan said, it sounded like Ryan may be not only attending the Presbyterian Church, but following a Presbyterian mode of life that does not, for example, include the sacrament of confession.
Yes.
And if that's the case, that's a problem, because it would mean walking away from Jesus's church, the church that Jesus founded and that subsists only in the Catholic Church today. Only the Catholic Church has the fullness of what Jesus wanted his followers to have. And so to knowingly leave that church, that's a problem. Also, Jesus told the apostles, and this is in John chapter 20, if you want to look it up, look down around verses 20 to 23, after the resurrection. Now, previously, Jesus himself had forgiven the sins of various people.
Right.
And then after the resurrection, Jesus came to the apostles and said, "As my Father sent me, so I send you." And he breathes on them and says, "Receive the Holy Spirit. Whosoever sins you forgive, they are forgiven. Whosoever sins you retain, they are retained." So now, just as he's previously forgiven people's sins or not, now he's commissioning the disciples to do the same thing. And if the disciples, so Christ's ministers, if Christ's ministers are to know whether they should forgive or retain a sin, they need to be informed about the sin, that you've committed it, are you sorry for it, things like that.
Right.
And otherwise, they have no basis for absolving or refusing to absolve you if you don't tell them about it and right. whether you're sorry. So Jesus clearly expected that for at least some sins, we're supposed to go to his ministers to be absolved, and that's the sacrament of confession. So if you've committed, not only is it a problem if you get married without what's called a dispensation to marry a non-Catholic, not only would that be a problem, but also abandoning Jesus's church, that would be a problem. And if you've committed other grave sins beyond that and you're not going to confession, all of that's a problem too. Fortunately, the good news is there are ways to repair this. I don't know, because, you know, we did have some phone difficulties.
Yeah.
I don't know where Ryan is on his journey right now, but at Catholic.com, we have lots of resources to answer questions about the Catholic faith. I'd encourage him to keep listening and to call in again in the future. And there are solutions to everything that, I mean, I mentioned several potential issues with his situation. I don't know which of them are the case, but the good news is God loves you and there are solutions to all of them. So I would say keep listening, go to Catholic.com, look at the resources there, and call back again, and we'll be happy to help you through the situation.
Thank you so much, Ryan. I'm sorry that we had that phone difficulty, but we would love it if you'd call back as you have more questions. Let's go to Amal now in Canada, watching on YouTube Live. Amal, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, I just want to, first of all, thank you for all the work that you do. It's been really helpful during my journey to Catholicism.
Awesome. Thank you.
I have a problem with kind of just understanding how the God of the Bible is compatible with the created universe in which we are currently present, considering the vastness of the universe, the length of time that it has been in existence, compared to the time we have been in existence, the kind of infinitesimal number of other stars and planets orbiting them, and the random destruction of them throughout the universe, the amount of time it took for us to get on the scene of our planet's existence, okay. and the time it took for Christ to come through the 100,000 years of existence of our species.
Okay. Well, I understand the position you're coming from. These are certainly things that have been mulled over by other people. What I can tell you is, I guess I'd proceed along a couple of lines. One of them is, because God is God and not a man, he's different than we are. He is not like us. And therefore, we shouldn't expect God to behave or make the same choices that we would make as human beings. And so, for example, if you take a human-centric point of view, you might say, well, the universe ought to be very young and very small because humans are what's the important thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that presupposes a human-centric point of view. God is not human-centric, though. God is infinite, and so he has a much vaster scope than we do. And consequently, it wouldn't be surprising to have an infinite being make a universe of vast size and vast age, because those are also going to reflect aspects of his own vastness. And there's some more to say about this, but we'll do it on the other side of the break.
If you can, Amal, hang on, and we'll continue addressing your question when we come back. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. The number, 888-31-TRUTH.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Many Catholics ignore the Bible. They say they have the Church instead. But we should embrace sacred Scripture, not just as the revealed Word of God, but as a Catholic work, intimately connected with the Church from the earliest centuries. In The Bible is a Catholic Book, apologist Jimmy Akin shows how the Bible cannot exist apart from the Church, in its origins, in the truths it contains, in its careful preservation over the centuries. Scripture is inseparable from the Catholic faith. This is fitting, since both come from God for our salvation. If you're a Catholic who sometimes gets intimidated by the Bible is a Catholic Book will help you better understand and take pride in this gift that God gave the world through the Church. After all, Catholics are the original Bible Christians. Order your copy of The Bible is a Catholic Book today by calling 1-844-239-4952, visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Every Catholic has heard the challenge. How can you believe that? Don't you know the Bible says? It's a challenge we have to meet. If we can't reconcile apparent contradictions between Scripture and Catholic teaching, how can our faith survive? And if we can't answer our Protestant brothers and sisters, how will they ever come to embrace the fullness of the faith? In Meeting the Protestant Challenge, apologist Carlo Broussard gives you the knowledge and tools you need to answer 50 of the most common Bible-based objections to Catholicism. Be prepared to give an answer. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Challenge today by calling 844-239-4952, visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at catholic.com.
Purvis.
And I'm Deacon Harold. The Morning Glory team reflects on God's abiding love.
Monday morning, 7 Eastern. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest on the line, is Amal in Canada, Canada. Mm-hmm. And you were addressing his question about the fact that it's kind of a question about the inefficiency of God, that it's hard to accept that he made things so big and he made time so vast.
Yeah, well, partly I think it's explained by the fact that God is not human-centric. And so we're a part of his creation, and we glorify him just by existing, because we show some of the ways that God is great, namely he could create us. But He created other stuff, and that shows other ways that God is great. So partly, I think the answer is God's just not human-centric. He's vaster than that. And by creating a vast cosmos, both vast in space and vast in time, that helps reflect part of the glory of God in creation. I think there's also another couple of factors that are relevant. One of them is humans value efficiency because we have limited resources. I mean, that's the whole reason that we need to care about managing resources, because we've got a limited amount. You know, we have a certain amount of food. We need to make sure it gets to people who eat it before it goes bad. Otherwise, it's wasting food. You know, your parents, I'm sure, always told you don't waste food.
Yes.
Similarly, we have a limited amount of energy that we can use during the course of the day. Personally, I mean, biological, biomechanical energy. So we need to conserve that because we don't have unlimited vitality, no matter what certain nutrient supplement people would tell you.
Right, right.
So we have to manage, you know, what are we going to spend our energy on? And this is true across all kinds of different fields. Humans have limited resources that we need to manage wisely. And there's actually a name for that, because these resources have alternative uses, and there's a name for the rational management of limited resources that have alternative uses. The name for that is economics. And that's what economics is. It's the intelligent management of limited resources with alternative uses. And we have to be economic about food and our bodily energy and electricity and water and all kinds of different resources because they're limited. Here's the thing. God does not have limits. He doesn't have limited resources. He's omnipotent.
Yeah.
And therefore, he does not need to be efficient the way we are, because he's not going to run out of stuff. He can always make more stuff.
Right.
And it's just as easy for God to create a whole new universe as it was to create the first one. And so rather than thinking about God interacting with the universe as if it's a kind of machine that he's built to accomplish something efficiently,
yeah,
it's more like thinking about God interacting with the universe as if it's a game that he's interacting with for the joy of interacting with it.
What a great analogy.
Yeah. So he's not trying to like accomplish a limited goal with the universe. He's having joy interacting with his creation.
Uh-huh.
And that's part of why he doesn't need to tighten it all down and be super efficient from a human perspective. But maybe he is being super efficient from a divine perspective, because in order to produce humans, and that is one of his goals, not his only goal with the universe, but it's certainly one of his goals. In order to produce humans, you need to make certain elements like carbon and oxygen and hydrogen and phosphorus, mm-hmm, and the various other elements that are part of our biology. Well, how do you get those? So God starts the universe in the Big Bang. Our whole universe is in a hot, dense state, and then expansion starts. But wait. As the universe expands, it begins to cool, and three elements fall out of that: hydrogen, helium, and lithium. The three lightest elements get formed in what's called Big Bang nucleosynthesis, the creation of atoms after the Big Bang. But that's it. The Big Bang does not form heavier elements. It doesn't get up to carbon or oxygen, for example, which you need to have humans.
Right.
So you need something else to create those. Well, so as the universe expands and cools, stars begin to form. The hydrogen and the helium start to clump up and form stars, which get so heavy that they start burning, and they by nuclear fusion. So they're so heavy, the hydrogen and helium in them are squeezing together and forming new, heavier atoms. But these new, heavier atoms are all trapped in the stars. So how do they get out? Well, to make humans. Well, eventually what happens is the stars run out of their nuclear fuel. They've compressed the elements, the hydrogen and helium in them, to the point that they've run out of the resources they need to burn with nuclear fusion. And at that point, the star isn't able to resist the forces that are affecting it, and it blows up in a nova. And that releases these elements out into the universe where they can form planets like Earth, including Earth, and thus allow the development of us as life forms on Earth using elements like carbon and oxygen and phosphorus and things that are too heavy to have been made in the Big Bang. And consequently, in fact, a lot of the elements we have on Earth couldn't be made in an ordinary nova. Ordinary stars can get you up to iron, but beyond iron, you need a supernova.
Yeah.
And so, like, if you have a wedding ring on site, what is your wedding ring made out of?
Stardust.
Well, what metal is it made out of?
I don't actually know. Silver, maybe.
Silver? Okay. Well, that would be element 47, and that's heavier than iron. So the matter in your wedding ring was made into supernova.
How appropriate.
And we need these metals in order to have ordinary human life here on Earth.
Yeah.
So even though you might say, well, why does the universe need to be so vast and old so it can make the elements that we need to be here?
Yeah.
And so one of the things that God did was set up the universe so that it would operate according to certain laws, and so that it would make stars, and the stars would make the elements needed for life and planets. And so Amal had alluded to, you know, stars seeming to explode randomly. Actually, it's not random. We can predict when a star is going to go nova. Betelgeuse is on the chopping block right now.
Getting ready to go
because it's running out of its nuclear fuel.
Don't say it three times.
Okay. actually, even though this can look random and not as if it has a purpose from our perspective, it actually does have purposes from God's perspective. He has the joy of interacting with his creation, which reflects his greatness. He also is using aspects of his creation to bring us about so he can interact with us and show his love for us. And so there is a great purpose behind the size and the age of the universe and the deaths of stars and all those different activities.
Amal, thank you very, very much for the question. All of that help you?
Yeah. Is it okay if I do a quick follow-up question?
Okay, sure.
That'd be okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just kind of wondering, I know that God is infinite compared to a finite, and we have kind of like a more finite understanding of like the universe and how we manage resources and stuff comparing to God. But couldn't God just kind of create all those elements like right away?
Right.
Such a long period of time.
Yeah. He could have. He could snap his fingers and create the universe in situ, as it said, in the middle of the situation.
Right.
People have played around with that idea. But here's the thing again. It goes back to what I said about God not running out of resources. He has no need to do that because creating the universe in situ is just as easy for him as creating the universe and letting it evolve over time. And so he's not wasting energy. He has unlimited energy if he chooses to do it this way, because it shows his glory and he has the joy of interacting with this for, you know, all this longer history than just a momentary slice of history,
right?
Then that's up to God. And so, yes, he could do it another way. He could create us with all these elements ready to go right out of the box, but he doesn't need to do that. It might seem efficient from a human point of view, but that's only because we have limited resources we need to manage. God has infinite resources, and so it's just as valid for God to say, hey, I'm going to take time and have this great cosmic saga that leads up to my creation, mankind, and who knows, maybe other races.
And Amal, I'm happy you asked the question, because it was very pleasant to get to kind of hear it's a great story. I guess we could call it creation.
It's a
great story, creation. Thanks, Amal. I hope you'll call again as you continue on your journey. By the way, the first course in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics, as we have mentioned, is out and available now. In the short time it's been out, almost 250 students have already signed up. And here's what one of our students said. The Catholic Answers, this is from Mark C., who took the course. Catholic Answers has developed an outstanding series of online video lessons that teach the what of the Catholic faith and how to convey that truth to a skeptical audience. The course is composed of 41 videos presented in small bite-sized segments of 5 to 20 minutes long, followed by a quiz to test one's knowledge. The course comes complete with a study guide and with the notes one can take, and with practice of the techniques and tactics of apologetics over time, one can become skilled at explaining and defending the Catholic faith to a skeptic. The first online course Mark is talking about is the Beginning Apologetics course, taught by our very own senior apologist, Jimmy Akin. You can get the course right now and save $30 on it still. So $30 off of this first course in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics. Just visit schoolofapologetics.com today for more information. Schoolofapologetics.com.
Have a question? We've got answers.
Catholic Answers
Live.
All people are called to communion with Christ in the church that he founded.
People really gravitate to David Anders and his concern for the callers.
Tom and I are both converts. We've walked that path, and we try to walk it with the listeners at whatever stage of the journey they're on.
It's EWTN's go-to source for non-Catholics, converts, and answer seekers.
Call to Communion TV with Dr. David Anders, Sunday afternoon, 4 Eastern, on EWTN Television.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live, open forum. Emma in Hayden, Idaho, listening on EWTN Radio, is up next. Hi, Emma. Your question for Jimmy. Oh, really? Emma? No? All right. Hang on, Emma. I'm going to come back to you. Don't worry. We're going to come back to you. But let's go. Let's take a shot at Anonymous. Anonymous, are you there with us?
Okay. Yes.
Hi, Anonymous. Your question for Jimmy.
Just hoping to ask if you could offer some advice about how a lay Catholic would discern, I guess maybe, quote-unquote, God's voice or the Holy Spirit or promptings from God versus his or her own thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Just wanted to get your advice about that.
So I want to make sure I understand the kinds of promptings we're talking about. We're not talking about things like an audible voice or seeing a vision or anything like that. We're talking about little motions of thought that you have, like an impulse to do something one way or another. Like you, maybe there's a question you've been thinking about and maybe praying about, and you suddenly have an impulse, oh, I should do this in response to this. And you're trying to figure out, is that a little kind of nudge from God, or is it maybe just my imagination? Is that accurate? Is that the kind of thing we're talking about?
I guess on two levels, mostly yes. I'd say a lot of them are kind of nudgings or promptings, but I guess on a maybe a slightly higher level, but a smaller scale or smaller frequency, could God also use an audible voice to kind of direct your action or your choices, not in a puppeteer sense, but in a
guidance,
I guess,
sense.
Virtue sense.
Yeah. So the second question is actually the easier one to answer. Yes, God can use more direct, explicit forms of communication to guide us, including audible voices and visions and things like that. Those are what are referred to as private revelations. And the church has a set of criteria that it uses to discern those. In fact, in February, I'm going to have an episode of Mysterious World specifically about how the church evaluates private revelations like this. But those do tend to be less frequent than the little impulses that people have. When it comes to evaluating those impulses, you know, I there's no single answer. I hear various people telling me that, well, God told me to do this. And they don't mean they heard an audible voice. They mean they had some kind of intuition that they attribute to God, some impulse or intuition that I should do this.
Right.
And I can't say they're wrong. What I can say is I wouldn't attribute my own intuitions and impulses to God easily. Mm-hmm. Because I know my own mind, and I've got lots of stuff going on, and most of it is coming from me. Mm-hmm. And some of it is even, I mean, some things, I mean, we're all subject to temptation. Some of it is not good. It's coming from my own brokenness, or it's coming from bad influences in the world. It may even come from demons on rare occasions, but I don't look under every rock to see a demon.
Yeah.
But most of the time, it's just stuff that my subconscious is coming up with. It's like dreams.
Yeah.
Sometimes God can give you a prophetic dream. I've even had a prophetic dream once. But most of the time, dreams are meaningless. They're just cobbled together by our subconscious. And so I personally tend not to look to my impulses as divine communications. At least if I don't cross-check them with reason. God also gave me reason, and he gave me reason that functions much more reliably than emotional impulses. And so I want to, if I have an impulse to, oh, this is the answer to some dilemma I'm facing, I'll also think about it and apply reason to it and see, is my impulse in line with reason? Or is my impulse unreasonable? And you know, sometimes I'll find, oh, this is a reasonable impulse. I can act on that. It may or may not be from God directly, but it's reasonable. So I can act on it as opposed to, oh, no, that's not a reasonable impulse. I should not act on that. In which case I would say, I don't think it is from God or sound otherwise. So it's hard to say. Some people have a kind of theological narrative that they provide for, this is what my impulses are telling me, and that's what God is telling me. Personally, I'm more hesitant to directly attribute impulses to God directly, especially if I haven't cross-checked them by are they reasonable or not.
Anonymous, thanks. I hope that was helpful to you. We still have quite a few on the line, and I'm going to try to get to as many as I can. Let us go then to Robert in Cicero, New York, watching on YouTube Live. Robert, your question for Jimmy.
Hi there. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, Robert.
Oh, fantastic. First, I'd just like to say I'm a huge fan of this show. I started watching probably 2 years ago now.
Awesome.
I'm a big fan of everyone there. Also a huge fan of yours, Jimmy Akin. You're the one who got me started to the world of apologetics, so I'm very grateful for you and everything you do.
Oh, thank you so much. How can I serve you today?
So I have some friends who go to a born-again church, and one time their pastor was discussing the New Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And then when they came and asked me about it, I, of course, responded that the New Jerusalem isn't an actual place as much as the church. Mm-hmm. And then they asked me, what then are the dimensions that John talked about? Like, they say there are specific dimensions that John points to in Revelation, mm-hmm. and what then would that be? And I didn't have an answer for them.
Okay. So, the dimensions of New Jerusalem, and I don't have them in front of me, but my memory is that it's like 12,000 stadia or something like that, some multiple of 12 with thousands involved or myriads involved. A myriad is 10,000. And that of itself, there are sort of two factors that suggest that this number is meant to be symbolic. One factor is it's got the number 12 in it. And that automatically brings to mind the number of the disciples of Jesus, the original disciples, and also the number of the tribes of Israel. Also, it's got the number 1,000 in it, or myriad if I'm one or the other. Both 1,000 and myriad are known to be symbolic in the Bible of just a vast amount.
Okay.
And for example, in the Psalms, it says God owns the cattle on 1,000 hills. Well, there's more than 1,000 hills on earth. Does that mean God doesn't own the animals on some of them?
Yeah, that are right.
You know,
no,
it doesn't. So 1,000 in this case is just a symbol for a vast amount, which happens to be synonymous with all of the hills there are.
Mm-hmm.
So, so we have a combination of numbers in Revelation describing New Jerusalem that are known to be symbolic in other contexts. And that suggests that they're symbolic here, particularly if other things about the construction of New Jerusalem as described in Revelation would seem to be difficult to physically realize. Like, one of them is it's a huge cube. And it's so huge, it would dwarf most structures on Earth. And I'm not talking buildings, but like continents.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it's so vast that it would be hard to fit on the surface of the Earth in any sensible way. Also, even though it's got this enormous height, it has a teeny little wall around it. It's, by comparison, it's this teeny little defensive wall. Yeah. So if it's really heaven and all suffering has been banished, why does it need a defensive wall? Mm-hmm. And if it does need a defensive wall, why is it so tiny compared to the overall structure? I mean, you'd want a wall that's higher than the things it's defending.
Right.
So these various factors suggest that this is not meant to be a literal description of an actual city. It's meant to be something else. Now, Robert suggested the church, and that's a good answer. I would say not the church as it is presently, though. It's not the church in its present state, although there's an aspect in which you could say the New Jerusalem is present already. But this is presented to us as the future glorified community of God's people. And so I would say it's the future, it's the end point of God's church once all of the evil in the world has been dealt with and every tear has been wiped away and God has renewed creation. So I would say it's the end point of all that, but that doesn't mean that we should expect there to be a physical city that has these exact dimensions, which are known to be symbolic and that would be hard to fit on Earth and that has weird things like a teeny defensive wall it shouldn't literally need, and that doesn't even measure up to the height of the things the wall would be defending.
Robert, we'll leave it there. Thanks very, very much. It's open forum this hour. Next hour, Carlo Broussard will be here, and we're going to give you the Bible blueprint for purgatory. So if you've got questions about purgatory, whether it's something that you believe in, or maybe you have decided you don't believe it, maybe it's something you don't even know about, well, next hour is for you. Let's go to see how many we can get in before the end of the hour. We'll go to Ramon in Florida, listening on EWTN Radio. Ramon, your question for Jimmy.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I was meditating the Bible study.
Okay, Ramon, just to let you know, we're really close to the end of the show. If you could just ask me the question, I'll be more than happy to answer it.
Okay, I'll try to go right to it then. Hope you understand it. Can we infer any type of effect of the events of the associated with the Magi, and the shepherds? With the events, with the rest of the adult ministry of Jesus, they seem to have been maybe very popular events during the birth of Jesus, but then there is no reference later on the adult ministry.
Okay.
So my question is, can we infer any type of effect of those events?
Well, they are obviously events that were remembered by Jesus's family and that they talked about in later years, which is why they're mentioned in the Gospels, because otherwise the memory of these events would have been lost if Jesus's family hadn't remembered them. They do foreshadow various things. I mean, for example, when the angels appear to the shepherds, they sing songs which have theological or doctrinal content that informs the future ministry of Christ. I mean, they're describing what Jesus is going to do and the implications of his ministry for the relationship between God and man. So they do get alluded to in that way. They kind of set the stage at the beginning of Luke's gospel for what then plays out in the rest of Luke's gospel. In the same way, the appearance of the Magi represents the beginning of a pattern that plays throughout Matthew's gospel. You'll notice that the Magi are non-Jews, they're Gentiles, who do honor Jesus as King of the Jews. Meanwhile, the actual Jewish authorities, as represented by Herod the Great, seek to kill Jesus. Can you think of anything later in Jesus's ministry where Jewish authorities were trying to kill him, but he ended up being honored as the Messiah by Gentiles?
Oh, that would be his own death and resurrection.
Yeah, how about that?
Yeah.
So the Magi are the beginning of a pattern that plays out throughout Jesus' ministry and even into the Christian age. So those are some ways that both of these events at the beginning of Matthew and Luke reflect what happens later on in Matthew and Luke.
Thanks, Ramon. Thank you for getting the question out as quickly as you could. Jimmy Akin has been our guest. You can find his podcast, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, on the internets. And the topic today is
Holy Blood, Holy Grail. But we also just for Christmas did an episode on the Magi. So if you want to know about the Magi, check that out.
Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Jimmy's brand new book is The Bible is a Catholic Book. You can get that wherever you get your books. You can even get Jimmy reading it to you on Audible or Amazon.com. Coming up next, The Bible Blueprint for Purgatory with Carla Broussard. You've got questions about purgatory.
This is going to be a How to Go to Purgatory show?
Not How to Go to Purgatory.
Oh, okay.
No, but it would be about, it might actually help you avoid some purgatory.
Okay.
If you pay close attention. Right back after this.
Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
It's so much more than just a profile picture. At Catholic Singles, our platform offers you many opportunities to get to know the person behind the picture. Sign up today at CatholicSingles.com.
Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at KaneFord.com.